So today we're talking about Anna Akhmatova and her poem sequence, or her song cycle, I guess you could call it, Requiem. Right? If you looked at the biographical information, you know that Akhmatova was caught up, she and her entire family were caught up in Stalin's purges, his post-Russian Revolution purges, which end up kind of silencing her for a lot of her adult life. Requiem, the poem that's included in your anthology, is written about the incarceration and imprisonment and incarceration and eventually time spent in the gulag, the internal exile or the work camps of Siberia, for her son. Right, so we've got it ostensibly has 10 poems to it, but there are a few more than 10 because she's got the kind of the intro, and then instead of a preface, the dedication, then the prologue, and then she really starts numbering the poems. Right? She's certainly the most important female Russian poet of the 20th century. And you can see why, if you just look, even if you look at her biographical information, you can see why she kind of runs afoul of the state in Russia. Right? If you look at the title of her volumes, right? Evening and then Rosary. Well, Rosary, you know what a Rosary is, right? It's this aid to meditation that is particularly religious, right? It helps you pray, supposedly. And then after she's kind of condemned by Soviet critics as bourgeois and aristocratic because of her, right, they say, narrow preoccupation with love and God, the next volume she comes out with is titled Anno Domini. And the Roman numerals there mean 1922. Anno Domini, A.D., Year of Our Lord. She's just been condemned for being preoccupied with God. And here, the next volume is going to directly address God just in the title. Years later, in 1935, is when she starts composing a Requiem, right, about her son Lev. And she talks about being there at the Krestri prison, and we'll talk a little bit about that. If you scroll down to the end of that pages and hit the page with the images, you'll see lots of illustrations of things within that text, right? The Neva River, the Krestri prison, what Black Marias looked like, work in a gulag, what an icon and an icon shelf is, and then the wives of the Strelsky, we'll talk about that. Catherine's Palace, what a censor is. We kind of walk on through this, right? But, I mean, the mere title of this poem tells you that she is specifically talking about something religious, right? A requiem is technically, it's the prayers set at a Christian, or specifically Catholic, Roman Catholic, or in this case, Russian or Greek Orthodox funeral liturgy. It's a series of 7 prayers all said at that liturgy, or the musical setting of those prayers. She's going to basically use all these instead of this, right? Now, she had that beginning, those first 4 lines, she had plenty of opportunities to kind of escape to the West. She could have been smuggled out. She could have gotten a tourist visa. She had plenty of people who were offering to do that for her, but she stayed. She stayed despite what went on. She stayed in Russia. And so she's playing with the idea of the mother here, right? It's a mother mourning for her child. You'll see one of the images is of Pietà, Michelangelo's Pietà, right? The idea that this reverses the natural order, right? But it's not just her. Remember how we talked about Whitman and his idea of the concentric circles with Whitman in the center and then all Americans and then all humans? Well, Akhmatova is very personal about this, right? But she's, as a mother, represents all the mothers in Russia and represents Russia itself, right? When Russians talk about their country, they talk about Mother Russia. And so Akhmatova's got her own kind of triple usage here as well. Herself individually as a mother, the mothers of all these other people who are being held for trial, who are being accused of being enemies of the state. And believe me, 98% of these people who are accused of enemies of the state, they're either going to be dead or in a gulag, right? It's very rare for any of these people to be found innocent, right? So we're going to see her kind of combat or deal with the rise of the police state here. And that section about instead of a preface talks about waiting there in front of the prison where she's going to see her son. Now, Russian prisons at this time are a lot different than our prisons, right? We talk about our prisons as three hots and a cot, right? You're going to get three meals a day, going to get housing, going to get health care, right? Not so with Russian prisons at this time. If a prisoner wanted to eat, somebody from the outside needed to bring them food. And so these people line up, these women, mothers, sisters, daughters, wives, cousins, they line up at the front door of this prison every day with something they're going to give the guard because they're not going to be able to see those who are in prison. I think in the 17 months he was in that prison, I think she saw him twice for less than 15 minutes each time. So you basically bring your food, give it to the guards, and it's a conundrum, isn't it? Because if it's too good, you don't know how much of that's going to make it to your prisoner. The guards might take it themselves. If it's too bad, they might not do it, depending on what kind of mood they're in or whatever. And she's talking about that, about standing there for these 17 months in the prison lines. Once someone recognized her, and there was a woman with bluish lips standing behind me, who of course had never heard me called my name before, woke up from the stupor to which everyone had succumbed and whispered in my ear, "Can you describe this?" And I answered, "Yes, I can." And then something that looked like a smile passed over what had once been her face. And this, written years after the fact, is a big modernist move, right? Yes, I can describe this. And guess what this poem is? This is the description of that. Can you describe, not just standing in front of this prison, can you describe the Yeltsin terror? Can you describe Stalin's rise to power? Can you describe the purges, the kind of internal gulags, the fear, the trepidation? And she says, she begins with that dedication, "The natural world changes. Mountains bow down to this grief. Mighty rivers cease to flow, but these man-made things, they hold firm," right? And we did this every day. We would, right? "We wouldn't know we are those who everywhere hear only the rasp of the hateful key and the soldier's heavy tread. We rose as if for an early service," right? Talking about going to church, going to mass, going to morning mass. "Trudged through the savage capital and met there more lifeless than the dead. But hope keeps singing from afar," right? We are more lifeless than the dead, and yet we are hopeful, right? It's not like everybody who was there ends up getting sent to internal exile or work camps in the gulag. Just the overwhelming majority of them, but they're still holding out hope. In fact, she finds out, right, what happens, right? "The verdict, and her tears gush forth. Someone else, some mother, some daughter, some sister, some wife standing there in the line. The person she's there for has been given his verdict and been found guilty." And guess what? The one thing that she had is taken from her then, hope. Because now she knows, right? Even if he's found innocent, now she knows. She is no longer a part of the group. Already she is cut off from the rest, as if they painfully wrenched life from her heart, as if they brutally knocked her flat. They've taken away even her hope because she has the verdict, right? Everybody else there is waiting in hope because whoever they're there for hasn't had their verdict yet. But here she is, she goes on staggering alone, and then Akhmatova asks, "Where now are my chance friends of those two diabolical years? What's up with them? Are they still worrying about what's going on in Siberia? I bet they are." And she begins then the prologue, and the first poem, number one, right, she's talking literally about her husband, right? As you see in your gloss, Nikolai Punin, who is, right, doing something illegal, actually. In the dark front room, all the kids are crying. In fact, Lev Gumilyov is one of those kids. And by the icon shelf, the candle is dying. You see what the icon shelf is. You see what an icon is. Good Russian Orthodox houses had these things. Even though they were declared illegal by the state, right? You keep that vigil light burning, right? You revere that saint or that image of the divine there. And in Russian Orthodoxy, we talk about the iconostasis, the wall of the icon being literally a passageway into heaven, a way to commune with the divine, right? He had just been finished praying there, and he was just sent off, just taken away, right? And she says, I will be like the wives of the Strelsky, howling under the Kremlin towers. And this wives of the Strelsky, this is a heartbreaking story, right? You see that they are, your gloss tells you that they're accused of rebelling against Peter the Great, right? They were kind of his elite guard, right? The presidential guards, well, the emperor's guards, really, with Peter the Great. And they try to throw a coup d'etat because Peter was kind of descending into madness, right? And they thought for the good of the nation, they were going to do this. Well, their plot was foiled. They were taken over by regular troops, and they were all thrown in prison. And the prison they're thrown into is what we now call the Kremlin. If you look at that image there, right, the morning of the Strelsky execution, you see in the background, you see the church in the middle of what's now the Kremlin, right? Lenin's tomb is to the left of that. That's St. Peter's church there. I think it's St. Peter's, yeah. That was all a prison there. And the wives and the daughters and all the relatives of these men who were caught, these troops who were caught and imprisoned, they pleaded with Peter to release these people, that they were doing it for the good of. And Peter eventually, after 2 days, relents and says, okay, tomorrow morning, you guys all come here to the wall. And the walls of the Kremlin are really high. They're about 60 feet high, right? You guys come to the wall, come to the door of the walled keep, basically, of the Kremlin, and I'll release all your prisoners to you. So they show up joyful. And Peter lets the prisoners out of the cells, takes them under guard to the top of the wall, and then pushes them over into the crowds of their families waiting for them, right? This is why the wives of the Strelsky are howling under the Kremlin towers, because literally this is how Peter returns the prisoners to them, by crushing them, by killing them, by pushing them out like this. It's incredibly tragic. But she says, you know, that was a dark time in Russian history. This is now as well. And we see her kind of go through the stages of grief. We see her kind of work through this process. We see her mourn the kind of death and loss of her son, although he's not dead yet. In fact, he actually makes it through the prison camp after a few years, right? No, it's not I. It's somebody else who's suffering, she says. She can't imagine how she could be strong enough to survive, right? And she kind of calls into question in her previous life. Remember when, right, I should have been told. I should have been shown, you mocker, minion of all your friends, right? What would happen? You who were so happy before, you should have been shown what would happen. You should have been prepared for this tragedy. How 300th in line with a parcel you would stand by the Kresty prison. Your tempestuous tears burning through the New Year's ice, right? How many innocent lives are ending now? You should have been prepared for this. Nothing in her life can prepare you for that, because this is so unnatural, right? The idea that mountains themselves would bow down, or that the river would stop flowing. But no, for a child to precede a parent in death, that's not the way of the world. You're supposed to bury your peasants, your parents. I don't mean to be like macabre or depressing about it, but that's the natural order of thing. Right? Your generation is going to bury my generation. That's the way it's supposed to be. But when we reverse that natural order, that makes it all the more tragic. Right? She talks about how For 17 months, I've been crying out, calling you home. I flung myself at the hangman's feet, and your gloss is nice, right? Akhmatov eventually writes poetry praising Stalin in hopes that it will get Lev released. It doesn't. She eventually declares her that work spurious, denies it as part of her canon. It's really, really is bad kind of hack poetry, right? But, you know, she's a mother trying to save her son. You can't begrudge her that. The light weeks will take flight to the sense, and then when we get with section 7, right? The stone word fell on my still living breast, right? She's crushed by this stone, right? Never mind, I was ready. I'll manage somehow, as if she's trying to convince herself, I've got so much to do. And you think these mundane little things, kill memory once and for all, turn my soul to stone, learn to live again. Three things that are impossible. This is not checking things off your shopping list. This is fundamentally altering your life because something has happened to you that is so significant that you can't get over it unless something else is going to happen. And then immediately she thinks again of her own death. I'm going to die anyway. Are you really going to make me go through this pain and then die? Why not just take me now, right? I put out the light and open the door. Hey, come and hit me over the head like a gangster, or you know, be that fairy tale, or be like the secret police who show up. It doesn't matter anymore, right? Just let me die, right? This process of grieving here, and then this kind of nod towards, you know, half craziness, right? The terrible eyes of my son, suffering turned to stone. I can't even find solace in madness. I know what's going on. I see what's going on. And so I can't get away from this pain. All setting us up for kind of the culmination of this section 10, the crucifixion, right? Where she makes this ultimate comparison of a mother and her son. She begins with a choir of angels sang the praises of that momentous hour. And the heavens dissolved in fire. To his father he said, why hast thou forsaken me? And to his mother, oh, do not weep for me. Remember Jesus on the cross. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, right? Listen, he calls upon Elijah. No, it's Aramaic for father. Father, why have you forsaken me? Right. And then this gorgeous image here, this heartbreaking image. Mary Magdalene beat her breast and sobbed. The beloved disciple turned to stone. But where the silent mother stood, there no one glanced, and no one would have dared. Right? The three people around Jesus as he hangs on the cross. Mary Magdalene, who is beating her breast, so full of pain and sorrow and sobbing. And John, the youngest of the disciples, right, is turned to stone, just kind of sitting there, standing there, whatever. But Mary, the mother of Jesus, no one looks at her. No one would have dared. And that is crucial. No one would have dared. Why? It's because you don't get into that. You don't get to look at that. You have not earned the right. Nobody has earned the right to look at that, to step in between a mother's grief for her dying son. Nobody gets that. Nobody gets that close. Nobody gets to say, I understand, or I'm sorry, or I apologize, or I know you're grieving. You don't get to say or do anything because you will never, and honest to God, I really do hope this for you, you will never experience a pain like that. How tragic does it have to be to bury your child? That's why no one dares to look. You don't get to be there. You don't earn that right. Other parents don't earn that right. Other children don't earn that right. Even people who've experienced that loss don't get to earn that right. Almost blindingly brilliant here. It's so significant, right? And she says, I've learned all these things, and I know all these things. I've learned what this pain is, right? How suffering traces lines of stiff cuneiform on cheeks, right? And I pray not for myself alone, but for all those who stood there with me in the cruel cold and in July's heat at that blind red wall. And so here she steps beyond herself, right? All those other mothers and all of Mother Russia, as she says, that writhes beneath this, right? We're all standing at that prison gate. We're all in pain from this. And she begins then that final epilogue too, right? Your gloss tells you it's the anniversary of a death, the day of remembrance. But it's not the day of remembrance of her son's death, right? It's the day she remembers those other women at the wall. The one they almost had to drag at the end. And the one who tramps her native land no more. And the one who, tossing her beautiful head, said, coming here's like coming home. I'd like to name them all by names, but the list has been confiscated and there's nowhere to be found. I have woven a wide mantle for them from their meager overheard words. And there's this modernist move again. A mantle is a wrap, a shawl, a something that covers. It's not the thing above a fireplace, but it's a piece of clothing that covers a woman's shoulders, that protects her from the element. And she has woven this wide mantle for them. Guess what the mantle is? This poem. This is the wide mantle she has made for them. That kind of big modernist move there, always making you aware that you're looking at a work of art. I will remember them always and everywhere. I will never forget them, no matter what comes. And you know how good this mantle is? The fact that it's 2017, and we're talking about these unnamed women from 70 years ago in a country halfway across the globe and feeling their pain, right? That's how good this mantle is, right? This is what protects them, that we remember who they are, that we feel with them and for them. And she says, and if they gag my exhausted mouth through which 100 million scream, then may the people remember me on the eve of my Remembrance Day. And look, we're doing it now. We're remembering Anna Akhmatova, right? And if ever they decide to erect a monument to me, I consent to that honor under these conditions, right? Here's the deal, right? She knows she's good, right? But she also knows that right, this is it, that her life is more important than her poetry. So you want to honor her because she speaks well? Put that statue neither by the sea where I was born, nor in the Tsar's garden near the cherished pine stump, right? That's Catherine's garden there that you see, the Catherine Palace. But here, where I stood for 300 hours, and where they never unbolted the doors for me, right? You want to put a statue to me, put it in front of this prison so that everybody who stands here will remember the pain, right? This, less in blissful death, I forget the rumblings of the Black Marias. Forget how that detested door slammed shut. And an old woman howled like a wounded animal. And may the melting snow stream like tears from my motionless lids of bronze. And a prison dove coo in the distance. And the ships of the Neva sail calmly on. You know, this is the primal function of literature, isn't it? To remember those who have gone before us. And to prepare us for life's inevitable tragedies. Knowing that people who came before us experienced them too and survived and were far more articulate, right? The picture I have on the image page, a grief so fundamental that the term itself means pity. And two of the four statues from Akhmatova, one in the middle of a garden in the center of St. Petersburg, and the other one staring across the Neva at the front door of the Kresty prison, right? Brilliant, brilliant poem.